listening to that, Patricia McBride and Sam McBride. I don't think they're married to each other.
No,
morning to you, Patricia.
Not.
Morning, Sam.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. And if you want to pick up the phone today, 03030 80 55 55. What do you make of that, Patricia?
Well, I think it's a very interesting interview. Peter Robinson says that he's a political animal, but he doesn't miss political life. Well, you know, sometimes methinks he does protest too much. You know, let's not forget that Peter Robinson very much came out of retirement last year to mastermind Emma Little Pengelly's election in South Belfast when she was elected to Westminster. And it's clear right now that the DUP has a trinity of leaders, and it's a party that's in the holy mess. You talked about it there in your question when you asked him about the Westminster faction, the Assembly members, and now Peter Robinson is inserting himself, I suppose, into the mix. I don't necessarily...
Well, to be fair to him, we asked him to do an interview on the anniversary, the 20th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement. That was the context for the interview, and I then brought him into other territory, to be fair to him.
But now, given that he has shown leadership in other aspects of the party's operation, he has driven initiatives within the party, such as the last Westminster election, perhaps what he's alluding to there when he talks about the need perhaps to have contact under the radar between the parties to get the institutions up and running again in Stormont, is this a role perhaps he foresees for himself? And he's certainly... looking at commentary on social media when that interview was ongoing, there seems to be almost an element of nostalgia within the Republican and Nationalist community for the good old days when Peter Robinson and Martin McGuinness were in charge. And it's interesting to see that.
Sam McBride,
Sam McBride, a
number of talking points within that interview. He made it clear that the recent agreement, that, of course, many people in the DUP were saying there never was an agreement. Peter Robinson describing it as an agreement, then clarifying it. But essentially, he said that agreement was not good enough for unionism. Now, was that a dig at Arlene and the negotiators who put it together or not?
You can certainly read it that way. I think in the broader context of the interview where he's asking you and he's asking us in the media and the public to be more understanding of Arlene Foster's position, it was tempered, I suppose, by that context. But certainly, I think many people within the DUP will agree with Peter Robinson about that agreement. One of the difficulties, it seemed, on the outside of the process was that the Sinn Féin negotiators were very clear about what they wanted out of that. The DUP negotiators, looking at what they were asking for, money for Ulster Scots, things of that nature, things that didn't really resonate with their voters, it seemed like they didn't know what to ask for, let alone be able to get it. Peter Robinson, with that comment that sometimes you need to make a problem bigger in order to be able to solve it, that does seem to be where we're headed. At some point, it might be a year away, it might be 6 months away, it might be several years away, but some sort of grander renegotiation of the agreement, a St Andrews Mark II, where the DUP can really come out of that and try to say, we've got something here that's really significant to you. The difficulty there for Sinn Féin is that they really need to be able to say to their people, it seems, or certainly they believe that, it would seem at the minute, that they have got a clear win. They can't really come out of the process saying, we've got a score draw. The whole point of this was to pull down Stormont and come back with something more than there was before, not come out and say, actually, we've both got a little bit here.
So some people, I'm just looking at the reaction on Twitter here, some people talking about the maturity that you hear in Peter Robinson, and I guess he has a lifetime experience as a politician, and they're comparing it maybe to some of the present day politicians who are in the thick of it.
I think that is inevitable, and Patricia is right that there's a degree of nostalgia probably on all sides about this. We see this with Gordon Brown, where he was a very unpopular Prime Minister, but he is now seen as a very respected commentator on the political matters. And I think that one of the enduring conundrums, I suppose, about Peter Robinson, which is still pretty unexplained, is whether at heart he is the hardliner who invaded Clontibret and the man of wild rhetoric at points during the 80s and the early 90s, or whether he's a pragmatist who was really into transactional politics, the sort of politics he had with Martin McGuinness. I think this interview pushes us more towards that understanding of him than the former, somebody who was prepared to consider prisoner releases, but in a different context.
Maybe you can both stay there just for a few minutes, because there's a lot more to talk about. We'll do so after the news. So we're getting reaction from you today to the interview that we've done with the former First Minister, Peter Robinson, 0330 80 55 55. We're talking to the political commentators Patricia McBride and Sam McBride as well. Kieran in Belfast. Morning, Kieran.
Morning, Stephen. No, I was just talking to your researcher. I was just saying that Peter Robinson came across as more softer, more mellowed as he came near the end of his retirement as First Minister. It was the same with Ian Paisley as well. I thought he became like that as well. Like, things that him and Martin McGuinness done, you would never have thought would ever happen, but it did happen. And it seems to me, as they came near the end of their retirement, they kind of a more understanding that they couldn't bring any more to the peace process as being the leader, but they could still influence it. I think they kind of a more understanding with it.
Were you impressed by him this morning?
I actually was, and there was a comment that he made the other day as well, that it was, when he turned around, he was saying about Martin McGuinness and him had certain talks within, in Stormont, within the offices, and it never get out to the public. But it seems to be when Arlene Foster and Martin McGuinness were having discussions privately, it kind of got out to the public.
Hold on a moment. We have no idea, no evidence, if that happened, or how that happened.
Yeah, well, it was just the way he was saying it. I came across as that's what it sounded like to me. But it seemed to be like more mellow. That's what I came across as I talk as him.
He said, Kieran, thank you. 0330 80 55 55. Patricia McBride. He said that there were never raised voices between him and Martin McGuinness.
And I absolutely believe that. I mean, remember, I worked for both men, so I know firsthand what the relationship between them was. And it often involved disagreement on key issues, but it was cordial, it was polite, and it was respectful. And unfortunately, I don't think we're seeing the same reciprocity from Arlene Foster in her role as First Minister. And the illustrations of that are numerous. I mean, if you look at the issue going back last year to Martin McGuinness's funeral, it almost appeared at the time that Arlene Foster had to be coaxed or cajoled that it was
we don't know that.
Well, there was an awful long time before she announced she would attend. There was the issue around the soccer matches when the suggestion was made that the First and Deputy First Minister jointly attended a Northern Ireland and a Republic of Ireland soccer match, and Arlene Foster refused to attend a Republic of Ireland match. Peter Robinson has attended GAA games in company with Martin McGuinness. You know, there was a different level of reciprocity that just doesn't seem to exist right now. And I think if you sum up what Peter Robinson's attitude, you know, the subtext of his attitude to Arlene Foster is, you know, that she's a good enough student, but sometimes her attitude calls into question her suitability for getting things done.
Is that fair, Sam?
I think that there's a danger here that we're viewing Arlene Foster simply through the post-RHI prism from the end of 2016. If we look prior to that in more, I suppose, more normal times, the sort of times in which Peter Robinson operated, Arlene Foster and Martin McGuinness led the most united, the most coherent executive, the closest partnership there has ever been between the DUP and Sinn Féin. They appointed David Gordon as their joint spokesman to sell a joint message. That had never happened before. And I think there's an element here of revisionism that Arlene Foster was some sort of outrageous bigot who Sinn Féin just couldn't work with. I think that is not borne out by the facts. She handled the RHI scandal appallingly. We all know that. But prior to that, I think well, that
obviously a lot she of would evidence. Dispute that, but okay.
Well, I mean, that's a matter of my
it's opinion. A matter of opinion.
But I mean, really, if we look at more normal political times with an opposition at Stormont, the DUP and Sinn Féin were moving closer and closer together. And I think that was one of the difficulties for Sinn Féin, that a lot of their supporters didn't like that. They felt uncomfortable. They felt the DUP were getting too much out of that. And that the tone of the DUP, as Patricia said, wasn't correct. But that was more of a difficulty rather than Arlene Foster saying, I can't work with you.
Within that interview this morning, Sam, Peter Robinson saying that while very few people in the DUP would agree with him, he said it was right to release the prisoners.
I think there will be people in the Australian Unionist Party snorting at that, and also people in the DUP. I mean, it is beyond question that at the time when the prisoners were released, there was no decommissioning. That was one of the major stumbling blocks, but I don't recall that being the only stumbling block. I certainly don't remember Ian Paisley or Peter Robinson saying we'd be fine with this if guns were handed over. I think it was presented very much as a moral position that these people were in jail in many cases for murder or for very serious crimes, and they ought not to be released. So that is, I suppose, something which contributes to our understanding of Peter Robinson, someone who at the time said this is something which really I can't in all conscience contemplate. Now, looking back, he says this is something that we could have worked at, but it would have required much more substantial movement from Sinn Féin and the IRA than ultimately was the case.
Patricia?
Stephen, I think what's interesting in Peter Robinson's comments regarding prisoner releases is twofold. First of all, the fact that there's the maturity there in hindsight and reflection that it was a necessary part of the process of peace. And the second part of that was in Peter Robinson equating, I suppose, the fact that prisoner releases should have had some sort of dividend for victims in terms of truth, justice or acknowledgement. Well, you know what? It's never too late. Stormont House had the mechanisms agreed for dealing with the past. And, you know, that's the problem. There was no implementation. There's still no implementation strategies around dealing with the past and addressing the needs of victims and survivors. And he's wrong when he says it was nothing to do with the DUP, that they weren't implemented. And the High Court ruling that Arlene Foster blocked funding for legacy inquests only a few weeks ago shows that he's wrong when he says it wasn't the DUP's fault. So if Peter Robinson's position is that in terms of prisoner releases, there ought to have been a dividend for victims, let's pay the dividend. The structures are there in Stormont House. That can be implemented by the NIO tomorrow. And we can start that movement forward. Judith Thompson, the Victims Commissioner, has been very clear in the last number of days that if victims and survivors can sit down in the same room and discuss mechanisms and agree strategies, despite their disparate pasts and the differing victim experiences that they bring to the table, then if they can do that, so can the politicians.
Here's Peter.
Something that I've been saying since 2008. So let's move forward with it.
Here's Peter on the line. Morning, Peter.
Well, I'm just listening here and I'm getting a wee bit fed up like a lot of our unionists here. You know, you're listening to talking there about Arlene Foster not wanting to go to Gilly match and all this, her sadness was. Yet you still have people saying we want to move forward and forget the past. And every other week you get somebody going to some commemoration, commemorating people who died 40 years ago. Happy the people's are, like Michelle probably hasn't known enough, you know, was young, wasn't even born when it happened. So where do we move forward? Do we move forward in one direction? I think if I looked up a dictionary and put Arlene Foster's name in and asked what the definition of it is, it comes back for Sinn Féin to blame everything on her. You know what I mean? I just think it's unreal. You're going to move forward, and that's it.
Peter, thank you. William in Belfast. Morning, William.
Good morning, Steve. Steve, we're going to use this word well-being, see if we can hypnotise people in Northern Ireland. The only way we can function is the well-being of all. Republicans need to turn around and try and make unionists comfortable, and vice versa. We can't have crocodiles, curry yogurts, bees, or loaves in hand. We must turn round and make the both communities comfortable. Well-being for all. Hypnotise them. And that goes for the newsletter, and it goes for the Irish news. If we don't think of well-being, I don't apologise for using it, if we don't do that, we'll go back 30 years ago.
What are you criticising the newspapers?
Pardon?
What is your criticism of the newspapers?
The Irish news takes a line for Irish people. The newsletter take a line for British people.
Well, every newsletter, every newspaper in the country has a readership
in a divided community, if you want to hear it, you have to be a bit more sensitive.
Sam?
More sensitive.
I think any...
You could play a part. Not to turn around and be a pussycat. You could play a part by having people...
Right, I'm a pussycat now, am I?
Saying that.
Right.
Judge Niver off and gets money for the just Republican.
Sam?
It's not unique to have editorial lines from newspapers. The Guardian in London is very fervently pro-left wing. The Daily Telegraph is very strongly in support of the Conservative Party. These things aren't unusual. They're actually very healthy in a democratic system, and broadcasters have to be somewhere in the middle of that and have to abide by very strict Ofcom rules. I think that's a healthy system.
If we come back to I guess what we're...
Stephen, can I come back in there?
Yes.
See why you've changed that into a newspaper talk instead of the well-being of all our people. I'm on about the well-being of all our people. Yeah. And I'm not saying that the newsletter can't take a union's view. But when it takes that view, it has to realise it's another community. The Irish news have to think that way too. Or you get the body bags out again. And think back 30 years ago. You get the violence back.
Patricia?
Now, please,
William,
focus your
right
minds on well-being for all.
Yeah, William, I think you're right, and I think maybe what you're trying to say, or I hope what you're trying to say, or how I'm interpreting it, is that well-being is about respect. It's about respecting the position of the other and allowing them to be who they are, but being mindful of that. So I think that that's where I would like to see, and
exactly,
that's where I would like
exactly
to see it moving.
Hold on, William, let's let Patricia finish.
Other people's. But, William, in terms of respecting someone else's views or opinions or culture or traditions, that doesn't mean that you surrender your own identity. So it's about being confident in yourself and who you are and where you come from and being mindful of the other person's position or the other person's identity at the same time. And I don't think that we've done enough of that. And I think you're 100% right. We can get that right. We can work on it.
Okay, here's Gareth. Next morning, Gareth.
Hello, Stephen. I was just figuring up really to say that Peter Robinson was the previous generation, and I do believe that if he still did have that role, he would be doing a better job than what his successor is doing. But the main thing that needs to be done now is for the baby reins to be taken off. This is the new generation. You know, this is the next line of children. They are being mollycoddled far too much. All we have to do is just take out the checks and balances. At the start, we needed checks and balances for the first 20 years, but it's actually the other way around. Now, what we have to actually do is free the whole system up. Just let politicians do what politicians do. Let them compete against each other with their different ideas and let them just take up responsibility. At the moment, they're on those baby reins, and at the moment, they need freedom. They actually need more freedom to do what politicians do and to... feel as if they have to take on that responsibility.
Okay.
At the moment, they're running away from responsibility.
Gareth, thank you. Just as we conclude here with both of you, Sam and Patricia, at the very end of the interview, Peter Robinson's message to the politicians was don't give up and that there is a way through this. Is one of the threads of that interview that it comes down to relationships? And can the relationship be restored between Arlene and Michelle, Sam?
It's partly about relationships. I think it's also partly about strong leadership. If you look at 1998, if you look at St Andrews, if you look at the policing and justice powers being moved to Belfast under Peter Robinson's leadership, there was a strong leader within unionism. There was strong leadership within nationalism. I think that the difficulty for Arlene Foster is that she is not somebody who can put a deal on the table, say to her party, back me or sack me, because they see her as a huge asset in the way that they did with Peter Robinson. The DUP never loved Peter Robinson, but they certainly respected him, and they knew that he was somebody who, in many cases, got them elected through his strategic thinking. So I think that is one of the fundamental difficulties there. And the other difficulty is that within Sinn Féin, there is much more of a focus now in Dublin. Of course, Sinn Féin has always been an all-Ireland party, but there is a much greater focus there. And the leadership now, of course, is based there and is not just based there in terms of how Gerry Adams was there, but is from Dublin, is from that particular political strand of thinking, I suppose, and has grown up in that area. Is there still the same commitment and the same focus within Sinn Féin on the instrument? I'm not sure that there is.
Do you think, Patricia McBride, the present day team within the DUP will have enjoyed that interview with Peter Robinson?
Well, I think, I'm not sure that enjoy is the right word, but they certainly will have, if they're smart, taking some things away from it. And one of the things is what Sam said earlier. If we look to the most recent round of talks where the DUP were not clear what it was that they wanted. And I think if you look at the party right now, and especially at Arlene Foster as the leader, it's like a Dickensian novel. She has the ghost of Christmas past in Peter Robinson coming back and reminding her what has gone before. The ghost of Christmas present is Andrew Crawford and the RHI and all of that that's going to come in the next few days. And if you look at what's yet to come, it's going to be the fallout from Jim Wales and the comments that he's made this week. And like it or not, Jim Wales is someone who represents the traditional sort of Christian wing of the DUP party. So Arlene Foster's choice now as the leader is whether or not she heeds the advice of her ghosts and she transforms herself and transforms the party. Otherwise, she's going to be like Jacob Marley and she's going to be doomed to wander around in the chains of her own making. So it's a very interesting time and there's all to play for in the DUP.
And I guess finally, Sam, at least Peter Robinson saying he doesn't scream at the radio between 9 and half 10 anymore.
And also, I suppose the other thing which struck me was that he was doing a very long interview with you. That's not something which I recall him doing very often when he was in post, and certainly not something which Arlene Foster has been doing recently with anyone. That I suppose, is one of the luxuries of being out of office. And there was a confidence and a clear-sightedness, I suppose, in what he said, which I think will, for many people, both inside and outside the DUP, lead to some sort of nostalgic thinking, that perhaps if people like him were still involved in politics, things would be different. Maybe they wouldn't be different, but I think people will ponder on that.
OK. Sam McBride and Patricia McBride, thank you very much indeed. 20 past 10. We're putting a podcast out of that full interview. It should be online right now, actually. If it's not, we'll get it up very quickly. Where do we get our podcast from, Vinny? How do we get those? I have no idea. bbc.co.uk/Nolan. How did I not know that? Right, bbc.co.uk/Nolan if you want to find the full interview on our podcast. Or, of course, it'll be online on the BBC iPlayer. We'll send out a link in my Twitter feed as well at Stephen Nolan if you want to hear that interview again.